Okay, so I mentioned then what the sort of issues that have come up in the past couple of days about emergence, what's the relation between micro and macro, what's the role of symmetry, and also what's the nature of prediction in emergent phenomena. So the outline for the talk then, I'm going to look at a couple of different ways of thinking about emergence, then go on and talk about the relationship between emergence and what Lachlan and Pine call quantum protectorates, then how this relates to what's the relationship between symmetry, spontaneous symmetry breaking and effective theories, and then symmetry breaking in the order parameter, and then some conclusions. So all of this is an attempt to answer these questions about prediction, micro-macro relations, symmetry, and how this all might fit together in a bigger picture. So there's essentially, well, there are many different conceptions of emergence, but two that I want to focus on. One is the philosophical definition of emergence, and that kind of comes out of issues in the philosophy of mind and the philosophy of psychology, but it's one that philosophers use very often to talk about emergent phenomena. And that is that the emergent phenomena are those that can't be reduced, explained, or predicted from the microphysical base using first principles. Now, the problem with that, there are many problems with that definition, but one of the problems with the definition is that it can be satisfied on purely epistemological grounds. So it means that emergence might simply point to a gap in our knowledge. We're just not smart enough to figure out what the relationship is between these phenomena we call emergence and their microphysical base. So if we were clever enough, if we could do the derivations, then we'd be able to show what the connection was, and the phenomena might not be thought as emergent after all. So that epistemic account also relates to the notion of novelty and surprise. We think emergent phenomena are novel, we're surprised by them, partly because we can't figure out what the exact relationship is between micro and macro. Now, but the Anderson account of emergence says that the whole isn't just greater than, but very different from its parts. Now, that seems to point to a kind of ontological characterization of emergence. The emergent phenomena are something physically different from their underlying, from what their underlying microphysics actually is. And it doesn't matter then in those cases whether we're surprised by it, whether we are clever enough to do derivations. We've got something physically different. So it's an ontological claim. So the philosophical definition then leaves emergence in a kind of undetermined category, because it could be the result of us, it could be our ignorance, that's why phenomena are emergent. This is a much more focused account in saying that, no, there is something very physically different about emergent phenomena. So then the question becomes, well, how can we explain something like superconductivity, which we take to be an emergent phenomena? How can we explain that in a way that captures ontological distinctness from the micro-ontology of Cooper pairing, because we assume that Cooper pairing is the microphysical causal base for superconducting phenomena. So how is it that we can think of superconductivity as a sort of emergent phenomena? So what's the difference here that makes a difference? What is it that characterizes emergent phenomena as different from the microphysics in a way that allows us to distinguish emergent phenomena from resultants or aggregates? Because in aggregates, we have something like the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, but it's not necessarily different. If we break the aggregate system down, we can break it down to its micro constituents. We can make predictions from the micro constituents about what the aggregate is going to look like. Those are the kinds of things we claim we can't do with phenomena that are properly emergent. Well, renormalization group methods show us how critical point behavior is insensitive to the Hamiltonian governing the microphysical base. But again, is that really sufficient? Because again, what we've got here going on is the issue about levels. Maybe we want to say, well, look, we've just got different levels of explanation. And we needn't appeal, for example, to micro properties when we're explaining the nature of fluids. So this micro-macro relationship, again, is important to kind of sort out what's going on here with the this kind of comparison. So again, is emergence just simply an appeal to novelty and level of explanation? Anderson's definition seems to say no. Okay, so what about this notion then of quantum protection? So Lachlan and Pines, in their 2000 paper, characterize emergent phenomena. They call them quantum protectorates, and they say that they're phenomena whose behavior is stable and exact, regardless of changes to the microphysics. And then another important sort of defining characteristic that they point to is that these emergent phenomena are governed by higher organizing principles and nothing else. And a couple of one of the examples they give is the Josephson effect. They Bose condensates, antiferromagnetism, superfluidity. So all of these are what are called quantum protectorates. They satisfy this definition and are governed by these higher organizing principles. Now, when we're talking about superconductivity in this sense, we say, well, superconductivity is an emergent phenomena. And if we're thinking about quantum protection, the definition of quantum protectorates that Lachlan and Pines talk about, then we need to becomes obvious we need to very quickly distinguish between different kinds of properties of superconductors. So infinite conductivity, flux quantization, the Meissner effect, those are exact properties, and they're going to be the same for all superconductors. Those are very different from properties like transition temperatures, coherence length. Those are properties that require a microphysical explanation, and they're not quantum protectorates in the emergent sense. So we've got, when we talk about superconductivity, we need to be careful by identifying what is it about superconductivity that qualifies as an emergent phenomena, or as emergent phenomena. But now we also think of emergent phenomena as the result of collective excitations, as the collective dynamics of the system's components. So here we get then into the issue about the micro versus the macro. We've got the collective dynamics, but we've also got these higher organizing principles that figure in the production of emergent phenomena. So what's the relationship between these two ways of thinking about it? Okay, so with emergent phenomena, we often associate them with effective theories that focus on appropriate degrees of freedom to describe the length scale that we're interested in, and then we just ignore those others at short distances. And the renormalization group is a method for integrating out these short distance degrees of freedom. So the BCS theory, which allows us to derive these various properties of superconductors, both the exact ones and particular ones, is an effective theory. But now the problem we've got a kind of micro ontology that goes along with BCS. We've got electrons in a metal interacting with the lattice vibrations. The phonons then will cause electrons to form Cooper pairs. The length scale of the pairs is much larger than the wavelength of the phonon, so we can neglect the phonon dynamics and construct a theory or a model with two electrons interacting at a point. So we've got this microcausal story about how superconductivity arises or emerges. But the question then is, those properties like infinite conductivity, the Meissner effect, those are exact properties, and they're true for all superconductors. So the question then becomes, how can we derive these exact properties from an effective theory that deals essentially with approximations? So how do we get exact results from approximations? Well, the claim or the idea is that those exact properties follow because the models that we use to derive them embody the breakdown of electromagnetic gauge invariance. That's a fundamental principle that's in these models. So we have something like with the relevant symmetry group for electromagnetism being U1, the group of two-dimensional rotations. Those rotations act on the two-dimensional vector, whose components are both the real and imaginary parts of the field. So then the symmetry breaking, we don't need to know how the symmetry is broken, just the fact that it's broken leaves unbroken a rotation by 180 degrees. That changes the sign of the electron field. And then as a result, products of an even number of electron fields are going to have a non-vanishing expectation value, but the single field doesn't. So the exact properties then, so that's a kind of very schematic way of thinking about the relationship between the symmetry breaking and the derivation of the exact properties. So they follow from the assumption that gauge invariance is broken in that way, and that's what happens when electromagnetic gauge invariance is broken. But we don't have any story about how it's broken, and that's not needed. So another way of thinking about it, that the consequences, which is a sort of similar, very similar story, that the consequences of broken gauge invariance for superconductors can be derived simply from a formalism that deals solely with the general properties of the Goldstone mode, which is a long wavelength fluctuation of the order parameter. Now, there's a long derivation of that, of how you can derive things like the Meissner effect and infinite conductivity. I don't have time to go into those details, but Weinberg lays them out in a couple of places, one in a paper called Superconductivity for Particular Theorists, and then again in the Quantum Theory of Fields book. But the point is, so the main point is that the characteristic properties of the system with a broken symmetry is going to be that the Nabu-Goldstone field behaves like a propagating field, and that the second variational derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the field is going to have a non-vanishing expectation value. So that those characteristic properties are going to be the important point for deriving these the exact properties of a superconductor. So when you're deriving then the consequences, if you're just using this symmetry breaking explanation or the symmetry breaking account, the important point then is that the Nabu-Goldstone field isn't understood as a phase of a complex wave function relating to the Cooper pairing, but rather it's just a field that accompanies the breakdown of electromagnetic gauge invariance. So we don't need the microscopic story about how the symmetry is broken to derive the exact consequences. So Planck's constant doesn't appear in this story in the differential equations governing phi. So we've got a picture here then, a very sort of schematic picture of these emergent properties and how they can be derived from just the assumption of electromagnetic breakdown of electromagnetic gauge invariance, with no microscopic story about how the gauge invariance is broken. Now, in this case, then, the effective theory, the BCS theory, isn't really the source of the explanation of the emergent phenomena. It is only insofar as it embodies the symmetry breaking. So what about the microphysics and Cooper pairing, then? You know, what role does that play? And what's the role of the order parameter in this story? Because the order parameter hasn't been mentioned at all. And surely that's an important feature when we're talking about emergence and about emergent phenomena. Because symmetry breaking is typically reflected in the behavior of an order parameter, which is the thermodynamic variable that describes the nature and the magnitude of the broken symmetry. And in superconductivity, we know that the order parameter is the amplitude of the macroscopic state wave function of the Cooper pairs. So, and the Nambu-Goldstone field is also identified as the long-range fluctuation of the order parameter. So we want to tell now a kind of RG-type story about how it is we go from the microphysics of what we want to call emergent phenomena up to the sort of emergent phenomena themselves. So we've got a kind of top-down story that we've told with the symmetry breaking, completely ignoring the microphysical story, but we need to plug in the microphysical story as well in order to, I think, really understand conceptually and philosophically what's going on here. So we've got the correlation function then that measures how the value of the order parameter at one point is related to it or correlated at some other point. And we know that as the correlation length diverges at critical point, the distances become correlated and long wavelength fluctuations dominate. So we've gone in and RG tells us how to get to this, the story about how to get to this point. So the system just loses its memory of microscopic structure and begins to display these long-range correlations. So as the length scales change, the values of the different parameters describing the system change, and each transformation increases the size of the length scale until eventually the information about the parts of the system extend to those that are infinitely far away. So the thermodynamic limit comes in. So the infinite spatial extension of the system, what we have in the thermodynamic limit then, becomes part of the calculation, and it's that behavior at the very far reaches of the system that determines the singularities that are included in the calculation. So this is kind of just general stuff. Everybody here certainly knows this. And the transition, the phase transition is identified then where the RG transformations bring the coupling to a fixed point. So the idea about universality then is that the fixed points they're a property of the transformations that aren't sensitive to the original Hamiltonian. And these fixed points define, or determine rather, the kinds of cooperative behavior that's possible. So the important issue here when we're thinking about it in that way from the ground up, starting with the microphysical, the Hamiltonian for the microphysical system, is it's not just elimination of of degrees of freedom that are important, but rather it's this existence or emergence of cooperative behavior and the nature of the order parameter that characterizes the kind of cooperative behavior that we get in this system. The kind of the order parameter which is associated with the symmetry breaking. So what I think the renormalization group does for us is it illustrates the nature of that ontological relation between the emergent phenomena and its microphysical constituents. So the symmetry breaking account is also important because it shows us that we can derive these emergent properties in a top-down way. But epistemic independence, I talked about this before at the very beginning when I mentioned the philosophical definition of emergence, the fact that we needn't appeal to micro processes to explain macro ones is insufficient for emergence because that's a common feature among lots of physical explanations across systems and levels. The fact that, well, we don't need to pay attention to X when we're explaining Y. And that kind of independence, as I said earlier, is not enough. It's not strong enough. I think emergence is characterized by the fact that we can't appeal to microstructures in explaining or predicting these phenomena. So in other words, the emergent phenomena are distinct, and any appeal to microstructures in explaining them is not going to give us the kind of thing that we want. So the renormalization group methods, I think, reveal the nature of that ontological independence by demonstrating features of universality and how the successive transformations give you a Hamiltonian for an ensemble that's very different, with very different couplings from those that are governed by the initial ensemble. So regarding this notion of ontological independence, if we suppose that micro properties could determine macro properties in the case of emergence, then we'd have no explanation of how universal phenomena are possible. Why? Well, because the latter originate from vastly different kinds of micro properties, and there's no obvious ontological or explanatory link. So if we think that there's this micro-macro relationship between emergent micro-macro connection with emergent phenomena, then how do we possibly go on to explain why these universal phenomena, which have very different microstructures, actually exhibit very same behavior at critical point? So showing the independent derivation, I think, from symmetry principles isn't enough in that not enough in the sense that we want to try and understand the bigger picture about what the micro-macro relationship is. It's important because the RG is important because it illustrates really how phenomena at critical point have a kind of underlying order. And what makes the phenomena predictable, even in a kind of limited way, is the existence of these scaling properties that exhibit universal behavior. And that's a story we don't get from the symmetry breaking story. So, conclusions then. How and why is more different? I should have inserted a how, I think, in my original title. Because the collective long-range behavior allows for micro-independence, both in specific systems where we've got emergent phenomena, and then also in defining universality classes. So we've got two different routes, two different but complementary, and each of which I think is necessary for showing micro-independence in the emergent case. Both the symmetry-breaking route, the derivation from spontaneous breakdown of electromagnetic gauge invariance in the superconducting case, and the renormalization group case, where it shows us how information is lost as the length scale changes. So both of these together, I think, give us a nice way of thinking about how it is that the micro level and the macro level are actually related in emergent phenomena, and how it is, nevertheless, that the emergent phenomena can be thought of as independent of and very different from what's going on in the microphysical base. Thanks.
Reminding you once again that there's going to be a general discussion later this morning, we've got time for one or two pithy questions.
I don't know whether pithy, but there is a slightly deeper connection between micro and macro than you described here. The Landau-Ginzburg theory has one piece of micro still in it, and that is 2E. As you well know, the way the symmetry is broken, at least to some extent, determines what comes out. It's not sufficient to say that the symmetry is broken. There are lots of different ways of breaking the symmetry, and Cooper's particular way is reflected even at the macro level. It can be connected to BCS through the Gorkov derivation, and indeed, as Nigel has pointed out, high-temperature superconductors, or at least one subclass of them, has a quite different kind of symmetry breaking.
Yeah, of course, yeah. No, this is just the sort of example of how, if you think about it, the regular, in ordinary superconducting cases, how you can think about the relationship between the protected properties and the microphysics. So, you're going to have to tinker this story I think, to other cases. But it gives you a kind of schematic way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could specify a bit more what you mean by ontological independence and maybe rule out a kind of failure of supervenience or determination from the base level. So normally we'd want to say that there's going to be no difference at the macro level without some difference at the base level.
Well, I think, I mean, yeah, philosophers get bogged down with this. I mean, I, you know, sort of struggled with John Norton over this point several times, to the point where I'm tearing my hair out. But I think the supervenience claim just seems to me to be a kind of non-starter where this occurs, because I don't think, I mean, if you think about supervenience, what does it mean? Well, it means that the properties arise out of their base, but they're not predictable from the base, right, and they can't be reduced from the base or explained from the base. So supervenience fits quite nicely into the what I call the philosophical definition of emergence. But I don't think that tells you anything. What does it mean to rise out of? You know, that to me is like, you know, rising from the dead or something, you know. It doesn't seem to have any kind of bite to it. So I think, I mean, I think the question is a really good one, because it's a real challenge, I think, to say something interesting and substantial about that. But I think that when we move to the Anderson definition of emergent phenomena, and we say, well, okay, we've got the claim here that there's something different about, for example, the properties of the protected properties of a superconductor and the microphysics, and so that's what and they're not related in a way where we can, you know, take them back. So that's what I think ontological independence really is. And what it means is that it doesn't matter what's going on down here. If you look at, if the symmetry breaking story suggests that it doesn't matter if it's fermions or bosons, and it doesn't matter how the symmetry is broken. Just this very abstract mathematical account of the symmetry breaking is going to get you these properties. So, yeah. I think so. Yeah.
Okay. If I understand correctly, not every macroscopic phenomenon that is a collective phenomenon you would want to call an emergent phenomenon. So, for example, the properties of a gas satisfying the ideal gas law you would not call an emergent phenomenon. But if you freeze it and it becomes a metal and it superconducts, then you would call that an emergent phenomenon.
I think you have to, I mean, in order to characterize what it is to be an emergent phenomena, I think you have to really look at a case by case basis to see whether or not, you know, is this really different, and how is it different? How is the emergent phenomena different from its microphysics, and is it simply different? Is it simply different because it's an aggregate, or is there something really fundamentally different going on there? And so, I mean, because aggregates are very different from their constituents.
So late in the 19th century, people like Planck and I think Zermelo or so forth argued that there was an independence of the laws of thermodynamics because they were time non-reversible, whereas they therefore could not be derived from statistics. You're familiar with the argument,
yeah,
which were time reversible. Yeah. So we don't accept that argument anymore. But is it a historically situated argument? I mean,
is it a historically situated argument? I'm not sure I'm getting that.
Late in the 19th century, would it have been correct to call the second law of thermodynamics emergent?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, is there a context? That's a really good point. I want to say yes, but then you see, if I do, I'm caught. If I say yes, I'm caught back where we are going to fall into the epistemic account of emergence, because then it's going to depend on what we know. So I'm reluctant to bite for exactly that reason. But then, you see, I think that the issue is, well, if you embrace the ontological definition of emergence, then that assumes that no matter what you find out about the system, if it's emergent, it's always going to be characterized as emergent. So there's no further knowledge that you're going to get that's going to fill in the right sort of blanks, as it were. So then you're caught in making some kind of claim now about future physics. And that's a real, I think, a deeply philosophical problem. I mean, it may be a problem for physics too, but it's a big philosophical problem. Yeah.
I know there's more questions. There's a general discussion later this morning, so I'm going to ask you to defer questions until then. Let's thank Margie and take...